From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you being with us on the Bishop's Radio Hour as we head on into the fall. Not quite in the fall yet, but and shortly we're going to be talking to Sean Carney, who is the director of 40 Days for Life, the founder of 40 Days for Life. And 40 Days for Life, of course, the fall campaign starting up just in a couple of weeks. And we're pleased and honored to welcome in Sean Carney. Sean, good morning or good day, whatever time of day it is. Welcome.
Well, good to be back on. How are you doing?
Doing very good, Sean. Appreciate you taking the time to be with us. It's bearing down. You're already into the pregame meal and you're ready to go.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. 40 Days for Life has become a lot like the Super Bowl, where there seems to be like 3 weeks of pregame activity. So
right.
Much longer than 40 days on our end, and that's a good thing. I've been traveling a lot. We have the new book that was released last week, The Beginning of the End of Abortion, and I've been already to five states, actually, just in the last week. And so it's been very, very busy. And I start traveling later this week to do some kickoffs. We have 415 cities, the largest 40 Days for Life campaign ever. Praise God for it.
Wow.
And it'll kick off officially on September the 26th.
How many of those 415 are in the United States?
About 300 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's our growth. We're now, depending on which campaign, usually hover a little over or under a third of our campaigns are international. And the largest points of growth have been, for sure, recently Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
We've just exploded in Colombia and Argentina, who just rejected abortion, and then also Africa. We just had our first ever conference in Africa last May,
mm-hmm.
and had all of our leaders there for training. And it's just beautiful to see, you know, a lot of these countries, we as Americans exported abortion to these countries. But when it comes to finding a solution for it or opposing it, they definitely knock on the door of America for that. And we have certainly seen that with 40 Days for Life.
Sean, is there a difference in the campaigns in internationally than domestically?
Yes, the biggest difference is the hospitals and the government are doing abortions in a lot of these other countries,
mm-hmm.
And it's not just places like, you know, Hong Kong. I mean, it's the same in Canada,
sure,
where all the abortions are done in major hospitals run by the government.
Mm-hmm.
One of the largest differences, you know, a lot of our abortion facilities are in not so wonderful areas in the United States, but a lot of
right.
them are. You know, a lot of vigils, you could take kids out. It's a normal neighborhood, everything. There's nice businesses and homes around, and in the midst of that, the abortion crisis is going on.
Right.
You don't really have that in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
All of the abortion facilities are in I would say dangerous places.
Mm-hmm.
I know in Bogota, Colombia, there's a 2-square-foot-mile radius where there are 80 abortion facilities just in that small
oh,
area.
My goodness.
And so, yeah, it's just overwhelming. And Pamela, our leader, is a saint and has done a great job. And so, but yeah, those are primarily the differences. These freestanding Planned Parenthood abortion facilities that we have in the United States are very, very rare internationally.
Wow. So, say in Colombia, where you say there are 80 in this 2-square-mile area, is the rate of abortion higher in any of those countries, or is there reliable data?
There's not reliable data because in a lot of these places, particularly in Latin America, abortion's illegal.
Mm-hmm.
It's just accepted.
Right.
So it goes on. And so you can't track anything. And we have a huge regulation issue in America for overseeing the abortion industry, particularly since they consider themselves healthcare. But it's 10 times worse in other parts of the world. There's just simply no oversight. There's very little data. And we've been able to collect some by having campaigns there. But, you know, it's illegal in a lot of these places, but they're able to do it. However, in Colombia, since we're talking about that, that is Planned Parenthood International has gone into Colombia, and they've opened up multiple abortion facilities. And you know, when you hear things, it doesn't always get reported in the media, but President Trump defunded the UN and defunded the International Planned Parenthood. That is detrimental in a place like Colombia for the abortion industry. Mm-hmm. And so it sort of gets glossed over. We, of course, want Planned Parenthood in America to be defunded and need to work on that. But it's not small news when Planned Parenthood International gets defunded, and you know that impacts places like Africa and Latin America, very Catholic places,
right,
that it really hurts their abortion industry.
So, you know, defunding is a political football, for want of a better term. But especially in the United States, will that ultimately make a difference, or will, you know, your Planned Parenthood just, you know, turn to their donor base? And, you know, in other words, it may be a statement, but will it actually reduce the number of abortions?
Yes. I mean, that's a great question, because when people are listening to this, they're driving their car or they're jogging or whatever. Planned Parenthood is a big circle. And for their income, and their pie comes from three areas: donors, their services, all mm-hmm. of which mostly are abortion,
mm-hmm.
and then the federal government. So if one third of their income gets taken away through the defunding, they are forced to do what most corporations and most other for-profit entities do, which is go make more money,
right,
or go raise more money. And so, you know, for a nonprofit, which they're still considered one, it's ridiculous, to get $500 million of tax funding is insane. And so it would dramatically hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is something that we need to support, is the defunding of Planned Parenthood, because it's a third of their income.
We're talking to Sean Carney, the founder of 40 Days for Life. Sean, for new listeners or people who just love to hear it again, take us back to College Station in Bryan, Texas. How many years ago now?
Well, it was 2004, and myself and David B. Rank, my wife, we just saw our local abortion numbers going up, and we worked at the local pro-life organization, the Coalition for Life, and we just spent an hour in prayer, and 40 days was what came to us. You know, what if we just did everything we could in a 40-day time period? So we did 40 days of prayer and fasting, 40 days of community outreach, and 40 days of a nonstop peaceful vigil outside of our local Planned Parenthood abortion facility. And that was the first ever 40 Days for Life campaign, and it dropped local abortion numbers by 28%. It was the fall of 2004. We never imagined anybody else would want to do a 40 Days for Life, and yet city after city started asking us. And so in the fall of 2007, David and I launched it as a nationally coordinated effort, and we had 89 cities, the first of which was Sacramento, to sign up. And, you know, God just used this campaign. We do one in the fall, and then we do one in the spring in conjunction with the season of Lent. And now 40 Days for Life has gone from one city of College Station, Texas, to 770 cities in 50 different countries. And it's because of people's willingness to trust this barbaric act that is never justified, and to do something about it where they live, and to take it and to trust it to our Lord, and to go out and to be his hands and his feet and represent his love and his mercy. And that's what we've seen, you know, and we've had a number of abortion facilities closed, too, in the Sacramento area where you are. The original location, College Station, Texas, that Planned Parenthood facility did close. That's where Abby Johnson was the director.
Right.
And that's now our headquarters. I'm doing this interview from that building.
Very
interesting. So it really is a testament of what God can do at the most important level, the local level, you know. And this issue obviously has a political element to it. We have to vote pro-life, we have to defund Planned Parenthood and all that, but ultimately this is a sin against God, and it destroys his greatest gift to us, which is life and the ability to partake in creating life and supporting life and giving life. And there's nothing worse than a mom and a dad paying a physician to kill their child. And so, you know, there's something we can do about it. And I think 40 Days for Life represents the spiritual fruit and power of witnessing the gospel.
Sean, you mentioned in the very first campaign, which you thought was presumably going to be the only campaign, community outreach. What exactly did you do in terms of community outreach? It seems to me that would be perhaps the number one thing that resulted in that 28% drop. What kind of community outreach did you do?
Well, the basis of it was to simply make people aware that we had an abortion facility in our town. A lot of people don't know that. A lot of people don't know Planned Parenthood even does abortions. They certainly don't realize, many of them, how many they do and how dependent they are.
It's certainly not in the title. Parenthood.
No.
Half of the title is Parenthood. You don't think of abortion.
No, and yet you will not see a doctor at Planned Parenthood unless you're having an abortion. And so, you know, it's that was our number one goal. So we did yard signs, we did radio ads, we did a door-to-door campaign asking people to pray for an indoor abortion and tell them the statistics on what was going on locally. You know, the local abortion industry is one of despair, number one, because of what their product is. But they also have low morale. You know, the days of your average American city having a reproductive rights march or any kind of activism are dead. They just don't get out there like the pro-life movement. They stick to vague talking points about choice and freedom and privacy, but they don't really get out there in the streets at the local level in your average city. But the pro-lifers do. So it was a huge advantage we saw that, man, we have 1,000 committed volunteers, and they don't have any. You know, they have 3 or 4 that work as escorts. And, you know, that's a huge advantage in the pro-life movement. I talk a lot about it in the new book, because we have this sort of swelling of grassroots where you have Planned Parenthood staff members who are completely disconnected from their corporate leadership in Washington, D.C. and New York. Those people aren't dealing with any opposition, public opposition. Their whole world is politics and marketing. But when you're actually running an abortion facility in Lincoln, Nebraska, or Birmingham, Alabama, or Memphis, or San Diego, your world is much, much different than your boss's. And that's a huge weakness of the abortion industry.
So, again, with the original campaign, what kind of pushback, what kind of opposition, et cetera? Were you walking the sidewalks? Were there people calling the police, et cetera? Did you run into opposition as well?
We did. You know, and College Station is a conservative area. It's a God-fearing area. And, you know, but you still run into opposition. I think overall we're shocked at how little opposition and persecution we got. You know, and it's because of the nature of the campaign. It's peaceful. And today, every 40 Days for Life leader meets with their contacts, their local police, lets them know what's going on, knows where you can stand, where you can't stand. This is law-abiding. It is peaceful. It is in the spirit of the gospel. And so, you know, that removes 95% of any, confrontation. And so, but you get people driving by, they'll give you the middle finger, not because they're telling you you're number one. they'll scream, they'll do stuff. But, you know, we've never had an incident or an arrest at a 40 Days for Life vigil. Very, very blessed. And it's because we're professional about it. We take a lot of precautions and we spend a lot of time and money training our leaders. And we have legal support, you know, when they do run into issues and have, the Planned Parenthood folks saying you can't stand here when they can't stand there. Right. You know, there's little things that come up, but our goal is to make it easy for the volunteer listening right now to go online, to sign up, and to go out to your local vigil. All of the logistical work and the nitty-gritty has been done for them.
When you go into a new city, do you meet with law enforcement? Do you meet with the DA's office? Do you meet with those people to say, hey, this is what we do and this is what we plan to do, and we just want to let you know we're law-abiding and we're not going to, you know, we know the rules?
Yeah, no, that's the first step. And, you know, our application season for the fall campaign is the month of June. And so people, volunteers, are applying to lead campaigns. About 25% of our leaders are women, by the way, who have had an abortion. And so it's the first time they've done a media interview. It's often the first time they've looked up who's on their city council or who their police chief is. And so that's one of the first things. They go and they say, hey, here's what we're doing. You almost never need a permit in the states to do a 40 days campaign unless you're having a ton of people out there at once. But,
right.
You know, it's pretty simple. They always appreciate it. And what happens is you put a face with the campaign before the campaign starts.
Sure.
And that really helps. And so when Planned Parenthood calls and says, our grass is dying, which is a frequent complaint, mm-hmm. they're killing our grass, the police, they know our leader. They know they're not a crazy person. And, you know, a lot of times that stuff just gets ignored because we have a relationship with them.
Yeah, it seems like it's a wonderful first step because, like I say, you're completely with, you know, legal, within your rights, et cetera. And yet there can even be people in law enforcement who might not quite understand, or they get a call and, like you say, they're doing this and they're doing that and they're throwing stuff and they have to respond, and all of a sudden it's a media event as well.
It is, and it's a waste of our wonderful policemen and women who serve our country, a waste of their time, you know, and they know that first and foremost. So you know, it's surprising, too. People assume, let's say you have a liberal city, people always kind of assume, oh, you're not going to get any help, you're not going to get any support, the city attorney is going to be after you, the police will be after you. And, you know, they may not agree with us, but we've never had issues, real issues with the police or local city attorneys. And, you know, we've had the wives of police chiefs join the vigil as a prayer volunteer. And so, you know, we get a lot of support from them, and frankly, this is our right. And,
well, you know, freedom,
you know,
freedom
do this for,
yeah.
Yeah. We
freedom,
do this for
freedom
God.
Freedom of speech
and for country.
Is one of those things that, the right and the left, the conservatives and the liberals tend to agree on, you know,
absolutely.
Yeah. So it's hard. It's very hard for someone, you know, and I don't even like the labels, but someone from one side of the spectrum or the other to say, you don't have a right to free speech. Nobody agrees with that, or very few people agree with that.
Exactly. And where they don't like free speech are Canada and England. In England, of course, you know, that's their gift to the world, and now they're ruining their own country, but they have bubble zones. You can't even speak pro-life language within 50 meters of an abortion facility in London. It's not not an area of silence, which you have, where you can't, you know, around a public place that should be quiet, where you can't bring up certain topics. It's not that. It only applies to the pro-life position. It's complete targeting. Canada,
yeah, and in Canada, they do. So, I mean, they have these sort of human rights tribunals, and you know, they'll haul you in front of one of those for hate speech.
Oh, they're crazy. They really are. And we have these great Canadian campaign leaders. We have all these wonderful volunteers in Canada, and we need to pray for them. I mean, talk about living a white martyrdom. Canada is absolutely off the reservation with their leadership. They've just gone completely crazy. And, you know, I don't know what you gain by pointing out a specific opinion and saying you can't talk about this in public. It's you know, it's communism, literally. And so I don't we spend a lot of time in Canada. We make a couple of trips there a year. Just getting to the airport is not exactly those are all the fun stories of just trying to get into Canada and telling them what I do. But, you know, we go up there. Steve Carlin, our campaign director, has been there. He goes to the march every year. And they're really saints. You know, the Canadians are usually feisty, and they got great sense. They got a great sense of humor, and they need it. Mm-hmm. And you know, it is. They'll tell you, you know, how much we haven't made here in the U.S. as pro-life people.
Yeah, we've talked to our producer Gabe is very good about getting around the country and even the world in terms of phone interviews, and we've talked to a number of the Canadians, and they're just a delight to talk with.
Oh, they're great fun. There's yeah. No doubt, and they have to be because their country is going Looney Tunes.
Well, tell us a little bit about the training that somebody or the process. Okay, somebody in I don't know, you know, a little town in North Dakota says, "Hey, we want to have a 40 Days for Life campaign." How do you respond, and do you evaluate and say, "Well, it won't really work in your area," or "Oh yeah, that's great," and then what sort of training and guidance do they get?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I mean, take Fargo, for example, because that's mm-hmm. a great campaign. So we have two application periods per year, 3 weeks in June, 3 weeks in December for the fall campaign, and then the Lent campaign. And so they have to apply. They fill mm-hmm. out an application of what they will do, what they won't do. They have to commit to certain things. They have to provide us a location. We check out the location. We see if it would be a good site. And then they're approved. And once they're approved, they get instant access to our training. We have online training, and we also do in-person trainings throughout the year. Mm-hmm. And so they start going through it. And it's about an 8-hour training and has a workbook and everything. And we take them A to Z. And what's amazing is these, you know, wonderful, holy, you know, take like a stay-at-home mom who has, you know, a couple of kids and maybe one on the way, and she's just a go-getter and she wants to lead a campaign. She's most likely never done a media interview. She's mm-hmm. never filled out a permit. She has never gone into too many churches that aren't her own and recruited volunteers. So we take them from A to Z on how to do that, how to speak to abortion workers, how to speak to, you know, women going in for abortions, mm-hmm. and how to encourage volunteers. You know, it's very hard leading a 40 Days for Life campaign. It's unlike any other thing you could volunteer for. It's exhilarating, you know, and it's a tremendous blessing to see people overcome their fear and go out there that you recruited. Definitely a tremendous blessing to obviously see babies saved in your community. But it is hard. That is the every talk I give to our leaders when we get them together, I always start by saying leading a 40 Days for Life is hard. And, you know, they always have like a sense of relief because I'm saying that because I led 10 local campaigns and, you know, it's very, very difficult, but it is worth it. And so, you know, we take them through the training and it's done with joy. And that's why 40 Days for Life has only grown these last 11 years.
So when you go into a new area, do you alert the media?
Yes. Yes, and sometimes at this point, it's actually a problem for us because we're so well-known in communities mm-hmm. that we're no longer news.
Right.
And so
right.
the media coverage, we get great local media coverage. I would have no complaints. If I'm ever sort of down on the media, it's national media.
Mm-hmm.
And it's obviously easy to be down on the national media, but local media outlets, NBC affiliates, ABC affiliates, Fox, we get great coverage from that. Locally, because Planned Parenthood will put out sterile statements
mm-hmm.
that are so disconnected from people who live on Earth. And yet our local leaders, they're smiling, saying we're out here to help women and we have alternatives and fill in the blank city has so many resources for women. We don't need abortion. And so, you know, there's always sort of a joyful version of our story. And typically Planned Parenthood specifically won't go on camera a lot anymore locally. So we get great media coverage, but now we've been in a lot of places so long, something has to happen because it just can't be we're doing another 40 Days for Life campaign.
Is there, and we're speaking with Sean Carney from 40 Days for Life, and Sean, is there an ecumenical element? Is the Catholic Church still sort of the primary, carrying most of the water here? And if it's not ecumenical, how do we make it that?
Yeah, it's about 80 to 85% Catholic as far as the participants.
Mm-hmm.
The leadership changes. It can be 60-40, it can be 50-50, and it's primarily Catholics, evangelicals, and then your mainline Protestants. And we get a lot. We've done a lot to reach out to more evangelicals and more Protestants. We've gotten great support throughout the history of 40 Days for Life from Focus on the Family. We got some big endorsements from some leading evangelicals for my new book. Eric Metaxas, who wrote the biography on Dietrich Bonhoeffer, mm-hmm. endorsed the book. Governor Mike Huckabee endorsed the book. Ruth Graham endorsed the book. And so they really, the evangelical community has a huge heart for 40 Days for Life. And they're involved. It's not that they're not involved. It's just that we have so many Catholics involved. There are definitely more Catholics involved than evangelicals. But I've always thought the pro-life movement was the only real ecumenical movement in our country. I mean, that you can see on mm-hmm. a daily basis, mm-hmm. and it's something we should be proud of. God has certainly blessed this unity, and you know, we're losing the family. We're losing our respect for the dignity of the human person, and there is so much. You don't compromise when you pray alongside a Protestant or a Catholic and you're not one. You don't compromise. I think you're showing that the united prayers are for something that is extremely important, and that's why we've come together. So I think it's been one of the joyful things. And I'm Catholic, as you know, but mm-hmm. the Protestants and the evangelicals that are part of 40 Days for Life, they respect Catholicism. They see great joy in us. They see strong faith, and you know, they're involved in the pro-life movement, and it's a great mutual relationship.
Well, one day maybe they'll be praying the rosary with us.
You never know. I did have a Baptist guy, and he came in my office one day, and he was definitely in the category of anti-Catholic, which is very rare.
Right.
And he came into my office one day and he said, "I got to tell you something." Like, what? And he was always out praying at Planned Parenthood. He was a great volunteer. And he said, "I prayed a rosary last night."
Oh, my goodness.
I know.
The world's coming to an end.
I know. And I looked at him and I said, "That's idolatry. You're going to burn in hell." And he's like, that's what he had told me a couple weeks before. But, yeah, so, you know, it wears on you. You learn more about other people's faith. You know, if you're not familiar with Catholicism, the pro-life movement certainly is an introduction of that. But, you know, I had this Irish priest who I knew growing up, and he always loved all these Baptist preachers. Number one, because they played golf with him.
Mm-hmm.
But number two, he said in a sermon one time, they believe it, and they live their life accordingly. They believe Jesus died on the cross for their sins,
right.
And they make a great effort to conduct everything they do, whether it's spending their money or jobs or where to park their car, they take God into account. They mm-hmm. they have that relationship with Christ, and that's why we work with them. You know, and that's true in our culture. You know, we are neglecting God, turning away from God, and those who believe in the resurrection have to be unified, particularly to defend unborn children and the family.
Well, Jesus prayed that we would all be one, and Jesus tends to get what he prays for. So I'm wondering if this is the issue that unites us.
I think so. You know, I mean, these are dark times. There's no doubt about it. There's so much hope in ending abortion, for sure. That's sort of the bright light in our culture, that we have had this for 45 years, and that we're on the brink of ending it. That's why I wrote the book. But we have, you know, stuck dynamite in the family and just blown it to pieces the last 50 years. That's just the reality. And there's so much hurt and pain that leads to abortion, that leads to so many of the different lifestyles that we see now. And, you know, we need the Prince of Peace, and we have to be unified. I had a Baptist preacher joke with me one time. He said, "You know, we really don't have the luxury of arguing with you Catholics anymore." You know, he was kind of looking around at the onslaught of secularism in our country, and he's going, you know, are we going to stand out on the sidewalk in front of a Planned Parenthood and scream at each other about sola scriptura?
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And,
yeah, no, it's really true.
It's just true, and we need to discuss sola scriptura, and we need to discuss doctrinal differences, and there are real differences, but we are in this battle together, and we have a culture that is aggressively coming after us, and we have to defend our home and our right to believe and to worship. And so I think it's, you know, Peter Kreeft always says that the fighting in Northern Ireland stopped during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a great analogy that, you know, we have to lock arm in arm in these hostile times.
Old expression that my dad, who was in World War II, told me, and he didn't invent it, though. There's no such thing as an atheist in a foxhole, you know. And it's
exactly.
It's the same thing, you know. I know we're both college football fans. I liken it to that too. You know, this guy's my teammate. This guy's my buddy. We're working toward a common goal, which is putting that ball in the end zone. We're not going to argue about, you know, little petty things here. We're united in something.
Yeah, we're absolutely united in something, and we're, you know, setting an example, hopefully, to others that we can trust our Lord with the hopelessness of abortion, that we don't have to just settle and say, well, abortion's been legal 45 years, it's here to stay. The Christians don't have that luxury. We always believe in the hope of the resurrection, and that means that abortion can end. And when we look at what's going on, it is ending. It absolutely is ending, as we've seen, you know, half of all the abortion facilities in America close since 1991. So,
and the numbers,
you know, there's a
go
lot of
down,
good
yeah.
going on. There's a lot to be hopeful for, and there, you know, no country in the West has rejected abortion more than the United States of America.
Sean, tell us a little bit about the book, how people can get it, what's in it, et cetera.
Well, I dig down deep into the abortion industry and highlight some of these trends that we've talked about. And so it's very different from the 40 Days for Life book in that regard. But I use the same format, and I tell 40 stories, and there's a daily scripture and a daily reflection. So I really encourage people to get it, or to give it away to a family or a family member or a friend, whether they're pro-life or not.
Mm-hmm.
I really
mm-hmm.
dig into the issue and show how at the grassroots, it is fundamental. It is the hearts and minds that are changing inside and out of the abortion industry. And so it's called The Beginning of the End of Abortion. It was released last week. We've had tons of sales. It got a great release 2 weeks ago when we launched it, and the pre-orders over the summer. And so it's been a really big success because of all the optimism, I think, that we see on this particular issue. And so folks can get it. You can get it on our website. You go to 40daysforlifegear.com, 40daysforlifegear.com. We have free shipping and all these sorts of great specials leading into the campaign. And you can also get it on Amazon as well.
Very good. And let's see, the campaign starts September 26th, ends in early November, and then the Lenten campaign. I understand the people in Fargo know that you're committed to having the Lenten campaign begin on Ash Wednesday. So they've petitioned the Vatican to change Ash Wednesday to later in the year.
There's one thing we don't control is Ash Wednesday. So it was St. Paul, Minnesota that did a 24-hour vigil 1 year, and Ash Wednesday started on February the 6th.
I remember when Ash Wednesday was February 6th. I said, we haven't taken down the Christmas tree yet, and it's Ash Wednesday.
The Christmas tree is still up, and like you're watching the Super Bowl, and it's
left right.
Start. So it's amazing. And they did a 24-hour vigil.
Oh,
they
man.
They were serious. We were laughing behind the scenes, but they were serious. They said, no, you don't understand. We're renting a permit, or we're getting a permit to rent a ice fishing house. To stay warm in front of Planned Parenthood, and their permit got rejected, so they just had to do a lot of suffering and be cold. But there's tremendous sacrifice of people.
I'm sure Jim Ball up in Green Bay is laughing right now. Said, "Oh, St. Paul, you know, they don't know nothing about cold."
Exactly. Exactly. And Jim Ball has had many a night in freezing weather. He does the Sleep No More campaign for men, where they take the night shift in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Great 40 Days for Life campaign. So it is. It requires sacrifice, and no one regrets it. No one regrets going out for an hour and praying. I haven't met anybody. We haven't gotten that angry email that says, I signed up and I absolutely regret it. So we don't get those complaints.
What percent of the 40 Days for Life campaigns are able to do 24/7?
Usually about 40%.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times we don't allow them because of the location.
Yeah, exactly.
So the first thing we check out, and that the leader themselves, the applicant, is the location and the safety and all
right.
of that. And so there are a lot of places you just don't need to be outside praying at 2 o'clock in the morning. And
yeah.
There are a lot of places where you can, and it's completely safe. And you know, there's always more than one person out at a time, and
mm-hmm.
tremendous blessing on those 24-hour campaigns.
Indeed. Well, Sean, you've been very generous with your time, and I've avoided asking you about Texas A&M football.
It's looking good.
They're looking real
good. Really good.
They're looking real good. I think they made the right move.
They did. We got a new coach, and so I don't want you to ruin it by talking about how good we're going to be.
All right. Well, my alma mater is Aggies too, University of California at Davis. They just happened to be playing Stanford this weekend. I think you're going to see one set of Aggies lose this weekend.
I think so too. Well, I think you're going to see that too. We play Alabama this weekend, so it's another test for us.
Well, it's going to be a testing weekend for Aggies.
Definitely. There's a lot of mortification.
Very, very good. Well, Sean, always a pleasure. Thanks for all you do. God bless your work. And we'll look forward to our paths crossing again soon.
Okay.
Hello, this is Jennifer Campbell, Director of Trinity Pines Catholic Center. You're listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Dunning.
The Bishop's Hour, and we're pleased and honored to welcome in Angela Lai.
Hi, good morning.
Angela, good morning. Good to have you with us. You brought a very young baby with you.
Yes, he is 3 months old.
Wow. Is this number one?
No, this is number two.
Number two.
My number one is in kindergarten now.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Was it a tearful first day of school?
No, she was pretty happy about it. She... Did I even get a hug? I'm not even sure.
Every kid responds differently.
It was more dramatic to me.
Oh,
she
sure.
She was, yeah. She didn't even want to hold that sign that says first day of school.
Uh-huh.
But she did.
Very good. Very good. Well, welcome. Angela is an attorney and has been selected as the recipient of the Thomas More Award, which will be awarded at a dinner following the Red Mass on October the 9th. The Red Mass is a Mass at the Cathedral, a 5:15 p.m. Mass with Bishop Soto officiating, celebrating. And it is it's a Mass that goes way back in history, but it's for attorneys, legislators, judges, et cetera, mostly people involved in the legal profession. Tell us, have you been to a Red Mass
before?
Oh,
yes.
Tell us a little bit about it. It's very, very inspiring.
Well, the Red Mass is a very special Mass for what we call the bench and about the legal profession. Mm-hmm. It actually went way back. The first recorded Red Mass was celebrated in, I believe, 1245 in Paris.
Wow.
So
1245?
This tradition was brought from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly when we started celebrating that in the U.S., but it's generally celebrated in October.
Right. To match the opening of the
exactly,
U.S. Supreme Court.
Exactly. The Supreme Court starts the first week of October.
Right. Yeah. Very interesting.
It's a beautiful Mass.
It's a beautiful Mass. I remember I've gone to the Red Mass, and I ran into one of my law professors who's Jewish. And
oh.
I said, what are you doing here? And he says, I never miss the Red Mass.
Yes.
It's a profound experience.
Yes. Traditionally, we do have friends, legal professionals from different faiths coming. And we are also inviting members of the bar from different faiths coming as well.
That's very good. That's wonderful. And The and it is, again, it's on October 9th. Everybody's welcome. You don't have to be an attorney. You don't have to be a judge. You don't have to be a legislator. Even Governor Brown could come, a former seminarian.
We have seen him in the cathedral.
Have you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember one time being in the cathedral and Gray Davis walked in. I think it was, I can't remember, it was like a prayer vigil. It wasn't a mass, but it was a prayer vigil. And everybody looked, and, oh, there's Gray Davis.
I think he was, the governor was here just this past Lent. Mm-hmm. I think he was here on Good Friday or something.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, so everybody's welcome. And then there's a dinner afterwards at the Sutter Club. It's sponsored by the St. Thomas More Society. And then they were going to award the Thomas More Award. And you are this year's recipient.
Yes, yes.
That is
remarkable. A very humbling experience.
Well, have you seen the list of former recipients? It's pretty impressive, isn't it?
Yes. A lot of people that I've looked up to who I call mentors, it's a very humbling experience to receive this award and to join this list of recipients whose rank I'm really honored to join.
Yeah, the times I've been to the dinner and, they honor the recipient, then they go through all their quote-unquote accomplishments, and I go, wow, I feel like I'm listening to the story of the saints or something.
Don't expect that this
year. I don't expect that from you. So what's that mean to you to get an award like this?
It allows me to reflect upon a lot of the people who have inspired me, who have kind of, showed me the ropes over the years. And also all the great people that I have met over the years. Mm-hmm. I guess my vocation as a lawyer brought me to many people from all walks of life, and certainly including my bar family. Mm-hmm. The legal profession, we call it a profession. To me, it's more like a family. Mm-hmm. Receiving this award is, like I said, is a very humbling experience, because I know of many Catholic lawyers who, and judges as well,
right,
who have quietly done the Lord's work, who are way more deserving than I am to receive this award.
Talk about some of the things that you do, whether within your profession. You are a lawyer for the state of California.
Right. I am a senior attorney at the Enforcement Division at the state's Department of Managed Healthcare. Mm-hmm. My agency is the only standalone HMO watchdog agency in the nation. So I would say I'm very fortunate to be in a position to wear the white hat and help people pretty much every day. That's my job. My job allows me to help consumers at the most difficult times. As healthcare is a very costly
right.
thing.
Right.
It's one of the major causes of bankruptcy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. But before that, I was actually began my career as a criminal prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
Started in the DA's office.
In Sacramento County?
No, back in Wisconsin, okay, before I moved to Sacramento. And that gave me the opportunity to work with different people, including families affected by domestic violence, mm-hmm, and also including a lot of what we call juveniles.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in a very small county at the time. It's Jefferson County. Uh-huh. We have, I want to say, 5 DAs, assistant DAs.
What's the major city in Jefferson County?
Jefferson, I believe, mm-hmm, is the, I
mean, the
it's
largest
not,
city.
Right. It's not. Yeah. It's not a big city.
Yeah.
We have like 4 judges in that county.
Right.
It was that small. But it gave me the opportunity to reflect upon family stability and education and career pathways, mm-hmm, to keep kids from entering into the criminal justice system. I mean, being a small county, when we would run into the same kids, same families, same people all the time. And so even though I have left the DA's office, I continue to work with nonprofits that serve families affected by domestic violence and sexual trafficking.
Such as what would be the, some of the groups you work with?
My Sister's House is a nonprofit in Sacramento. We, in addition to, you know, having shelter and emergency shelter and like a transitional shelter, we also do a lot of outreach, a lot of education. We also work, in addition to domestic violence, families affected by domestic violence, we also work with human trafficking victims. Or potential human trafficking.
And we hear Sacramento is really
a
hub for that, I guess.
Yes, I have. I mean, we have different things. We have a legal clinic that help families, but at the same time, as part of the outreach, and I have participated in that before, we would go with law enforcement to like places like massage parlors. And talk to these potential human trafficking victims. And a lot of times, it's not the first time. You need to kind of plant the seed and tell them, you know, there's a way out.
There's
a way out. There's help. And it may take many times. Other outreach that we that I've participated in including we would go to churches of different faiths. And just talk about human trafficking or talk about domestic violence. Because a lot of families, when they need help, when they start having issues, one of the first places they would go to would be the church leaders or the church families. And so we do a lot of outreach so people would know, oh, you know, these are the signs to watch for. You know, this is actually a serious matter. And these are the resources. These are, you know, this is how you should address it.
Does human trafficking almost always involve sex, or are there other things that in, that human trafficking involves?
Oh, it can involve other things. Some of the high profile cases may involve people being brought into this country to work as domestic workers or to help clean the house, things like that. Human trafficking goes way beyond sexual related human trafficking.
Very good. So how did you come to Sacramento specifically for the job you're in now?
Well, my previous job, I work at a firm called Nossaman. Nossaman is a very prominent firm in Sacramento. We do a variety of different laws, but when I joined Nossaman, that's how I got into health law, and I've been doing health law for ever since I came to Sacramento. They brought me from all the way from Wisconsin. They brought me here.
Wow! Did you grow up in Wisconsin?
No, I spent 10 years there. I grew up in Hong Kong. I was born and raised in Hong Kong. The interesting thing is I don't actually have a big family in Sacramento. There's the four of us, you know, me and my husband and the two kids. But I am blessed to have I would consider a huge family. My parish family, my professional family, the community, you know, the community leaders I serve with, they become part of my family. So when my daughter just got her belt promotion in karate just last week, well, grandma came. Well, it's actually not her birth grandma.
Right.
It's, you know, somebody she calls, you know, her grandparents came.
How wonderful.
Yes.
So when did you come to the United States from Hong Kong?
I came here for college.
For college.
I
and where was
here,
that?
University of Wisconsin.
Oh,
I'm a proud Badger.
Madison. The Badgers.
Yes, the Badgers.
They're going to be very good this year in football.
Well, hopefully. I was there when we won the Rose Bowl.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow. Was Barry Alvarez the coach?
Yes. Ron Dane was...
Ron Dane was running the ball. Yeah,
exactly.
Nobody could stop Ron Dane, for sure. Camp Randall Stadium, that must be a great place to see a game.
Oh, yeah. I lived like a few blocks away from Camp Randall. I used to have season tickets there.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So it's one of the stadiums I haven't been to that's on my bucket list.
You have to be there.
Got to see a game there.
Yeah, yeah, to be there.
Wow, so you're a Badger. Well, welcome. And then where'd you go to law school?
University of Wisconsin as well.
Same place.
Yeah,
okay.
I was there for 10 years.
Okay.
I did undergrad there, worked a little bit, and then paid off my student loans for undergrad. Then went to law school. I worked a little bit. I worked, I worked in Jefferson County, which is the neighboring county of Madison, of Dane County.
Dane County.
Where Madison was. Yeah. And then I came to Sacramento.
Wow. Very good. So did you have to take the California bar after already passing the Wisconsin bar?
Well, Wisconsin, we don't have to take the bar exam.
If you graduate from the state university?
Well, we only have two law schools.
Mm-hmm.
Marquette. Brother actually went to Marquette.
Mm-hmm.
He graduated from Marquette, which is
a Catholic school. Right.
And University of Wisconsin Law School. And so as long as you go to one of those two law schools, take a certain list of classes, get certain grades, and you have to take professional responsibility. Mm-hmm. We have to pass that NPR professional responsibility part of the bar exam.
Right.
Once you have that, and of course, you know, they have to do your background check and whatnot. So once you have all of that, I graduated in May, and I got sworn in June. I started practicing law.
Wow.
Essentially, I want to say a couple weeks after I graduated.
It seems like a really smart way to do it. I mean, the state runs the school, and Marquette, but so if you fulfill all the requirements, you should become an attorney.
Right, and most of the people who practice there went to one of those two law schools, right?
Right.
The judges, the Supreme Court justices, they all came from those two law schools.
Right.
So it's very personal to them. You know, when we did any internship, whatnot, we learn to practice from people who graduated from our schools.
Mm-hmm.
So they feel personal about making sure the two law schools are at par. We're doing well.
Right. Very good. And so then you came to California, and then you worked for one firm, and then that got you into healthcare issues.
Yeah, I began practicing in health law and administrative law at my last firm, and then I got married. So thinking, I was working a lot. I was, you know, when you're a private firm, you do work very long hours, and we're thinking, you know, we're beginning to, you know, start a family. And that was when I joined the state. I mean, I still get to do litigation. I still, you know, I'm passionate about the kind of law, the area of the law that I practice in. But at the same time, you know, that gives us an opportunity to also spend more time with our family.
So how do people find you? How do people even know that this State Department exists? And who are your potential clients?
Well, our client is the state. The people of California mm-hmm. are essential.
We represent.
We can bring cases in the name of the people.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the state or the Department of Managed Healthcare is my client.
Mm-hmm.
That's who I give advice to. That's
right.
Who I represent in court.
Sure. And so what sorts of people come to the Department of Managed Healthcare? What sort of issues are they bringing?
Well, these would be what we call HMO enrollees for the most part, some PPOs as well. The Department of Managed Healthcare regulates the HMO industry. Usually when consumers have an issue with their HMO,
right.
Like, you know, I want to stay in the hospital and they're kicking me out, I want them to cover something they're not covering. I want to see the doctor. And they told me I have to wait, you know, 3 months to get a second opinion, or they're not allowing me mm-hmm. to get a second opinion. They're charging me too much. All sorts of things. First step would be they would file what we call a grievance with the HMO. actually essentially a complaint. So they'll file a complaint. It doesn't have to be, you can call and say, I want to file a grievance. Mm-hmm. Or they can obviously do it in writing, fill out a form to tell them why they are, what makes them upset, what they are complaining about. And if they don't like what the HMO, how they resolve the issue, or whether they, what if, for example, if they don't resolve the issue mm-hmm. timely, or if they don't, the consumer does not like the way the HMO addresses the issue, they can file a complaint with the Department of Managed Healthcare. Mm-hmm. We have a HMO helpline, and when HMO responds to a consumer, they also provide notice that, you know, if you don't like, if you have any further complaints, you can go to the Department of Managed Healthcare.
Very good.
And that's when they come to us. I'm not the first people they would talk to.
Right.
I'm the ones who would go to court against the HMOs.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But we are very helpful. You know, if anybody has any, it needs help, we are a very good agency to just call and ask for help.
Mm-hmm. Which is wonderful to hear, because many people have issues,
and they don't know.
They don't know.
Right? They get a bill. They think, oh, you know. They say, I have to pay in 30 days. Okay, I have to pay, and a lot of times they don't really think about what is my rights. You know,
right.
I mean, okay, I can't pay. What am I supposed to do? So they kind of sit on the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And not pay, not thinking that, oh, you know, there are resources out there that I can actually turn to. Mm-hmm. And maybe I don't even have to pay the bill. I mean, maybe
right.
I should not pay the bill.
Right.
It's important to know your rights, to know that there are places that you can go to get help.
Very good.
For example, such as the Department of Managed Healthcare.
Yeah. Well, it must be... must be, I'm sure it's humbling to get this Thomas More Award.
Yes.
And yet it must, you must have some excitement about the evening ahead, October the 9th.
Yes, I'm probably the first person to get this award while on maternity leave. And like I told the diocese, I'll have to bring my two kids because my younger one is only 3 months old.
So, no, you don't even need to get a babysitter. You're just going to bring them to the dinner.
Well, I brought my baby
right.
with me.
Right.
And it's,
I know.
You can, yeah. And I actually, my parish family is helping.
Oh, that's great.
Watch my baby while I'm doing this interview.
Very good. Well, Angela, it's a joy to meet you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I know it's a well-deserved honor. All the people have talked very highly of you. So, and we're glad that you decided to move to California from Wisconsin. Underwriting for the Bishop's Hour is provided by Catholic Funeral and Cemetery Services, a ministry of the Diocese of Sacramento. As a church-owned nonprofit founded in faith, Catholic Funeral and Cemetery Services is dedicated to providing education, support, and resources during life's most difficult moments. They will make every effort to enable you to realize your final wishes while empowering families to make completely informed decisions. You can give them a call. They are at 855-525-2285. That's 855-525-2285. We're also brought to you by a generous grant from Christine Cipperly, Marriage and Family Therapist. If you're looking for help with family or personal problems, if you'd like help from someone with a Catholic point of view, someone who understands the importance of marriage and family and affirms the dignity of every human life, Christine Cipperly is a trained and experienced counselor of married couples, families, and individuals. She can work with you on your marriage, your parenting, or your individual struggles in a way that will not violate our faith. Christine is a wonderful, wonderful therapist. Give her a call. She's at 530-400-4757. That's 530-400-4757. We'd like to thank Christine Cipperly and Catholic Cemeteries and Funeral Services for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening, everyone. God bless. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. Thank you.
held high. Such small sacrifice. If not joined with my life, I sing in vain tonight. May the words I